Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to give you an overview of what we do at the Molecular Imaging Chemistry Laboratory, which comes under the Wilson Brain Imaging Center. In this talk, I will be giving you a short introduction of what PET is, how we go about developing a novel radio tracer, and how we use a little bit of mathematics in there to model the data that we obtain from PET. So PET, it is an imaging modality where a molecule that has been tagged with radioactivity is injected into a subject, and it is tracked within the body so that a quantitative three-dimensional image can be prepared, and then from there we can extract biological information. So when I say radio tracer or PET probe, what is it? It is a molecule that is labeled with the positron emitting nuclide, for example 18F, carbon 11, 15 oxygen, copper 64, gallium 68. These are the commonly used ones. The ones that we use the most are the fluorine 18 and carbon 11. Carbon 11 has a half-life of about of 20 minutes, and fluorine 18 of around 110 minutes, so they are both quite short-lived isotopes. And these radio tracers are biomarkers, so they could interact with various things in the body like receptors, enzymes, transporters, misfolded proteins, and all this gives us information about the physiological or biochemical or pharmacological processes that are happening in the body. So the image that you see here, it's from the NIMROD study, which is happening here in Cambridge, which looks at neuroinflammation in dementia and other disorders. So in this study, 11 carbon pK 11195 was used, which looks at neuroinflammation. So it used the shorter lived carbon 11 as its isotope, and it binds to a receptor called TSPO, which is upregulated in inflammation. So in this case, they found that in depression, there's more inflammatory markers in the brain. So in general, what happens in a PET study is that a radio tracer is injected through a peripheral vein. It distributes within the body, when the positron meets an electron, there's an annihilation event which produces two gamma photons, which are released in 180 degrees. So this, coincidence at 180 degrees, is detected by the detectors, processed, and then we get reconstructed images. So now coming to radio tracer development that we do. The first step in radio tracer development is to identify a target. So I mentioned neuroinflammation before. So we till now have been using TSPO as the marker receptor, but there are several other markers that we could look at. For example, COX-2, MAO-B, RAGE. So to choose this target that we want to study is the first step. Then comes identifying a lead molecule. So this is done by looking at literature, what's available. Possibly a drug can be modified, a drug that binds to this receptor or target. Or, and I will come to this in my final slide, computational modeling based on the structure of the target to identify the best possible lead compound. So this compound that we identify should have high affinity to the target, so that we have clear image that we can visualize. It should be highly selective to the target. So if it is binding to TSPO, it should not be binding to some other receptor or some other molecule target. And it should have low non-specific binding. So this is a bit different. It should not bind, for example, dissolve into the fat, or so it's not specific to any particular receptor. There should not be any non-specific binding that would sort of blur the background. And it should have the correct lipophilicity so that the compound can cross the blood-brain barrier, so dissolve in the fat of the cell, dissolve in the aqueous liquid of the cell, again another fat layer, and come out at the other side into the brain. It should have a known metabolite profile. So when we look at a scan image, what we are seeing is just radioactivity. We don't know if it is from the molecule we have injected or a broken up piece of the molecule that is created in the body. So we should know what is the metabolites that are formed in the body from this compound that we have injected. Then comes the next step, which is chemical synthesis of precursors and standards. Precursors are the chemical compounds to which your radioactive moiety is attached. So we need to prepare that ahead of time. And we should have standards, which are the non-radioactive version of the compound that we are injecting, so that we can do quality control for our radioactive compound. Then comes the actual radiosynthesis. We need to have reproducible radiolabeling methods which are robust and fast. As I mentioned before, these carbon-11 and fluorine-18, they have really short half-life. So if the synthesis takes 2 hours, then already your compound is gone. So the process has to be as much as possible, single step, you add things, you do the separation, and you have your tracer ready. And it should have a high specific activity, which is now called molar activity, which means you have a much higher ratio of your radioactive compound to the non-radioactive compound in the solution that you're injecting. Because if there's too much of the non-radioactive compound, that would also bind to the receptor, and therefore we will not be able to see where your tracer is actually binding. So it could mask the binding by the radioactive compound, which is represented in the image here on the right. So the actual radiosynthesis, what happens here? So I've lost my point. Ha, there it is. That's the cyclotron in which the PET isotope is produced. So what it is a particle accelerator. So what happens there is protons are bombarded onto a target from which a non-radioactive isotope is turned into a radioactive isotope. So your radioactive isotope from the cyclotron is combined with the precursor that is made in the organic chemistry laboratory, and the reactions are performed in these hot cells, which are essentially lead-shielded fume hoods in which the chemical reactions happen. And we don't want people to be actually putting their hands in to pour things into each other. So that is done within these modules, which can add things, transfer things to a column to separate it by analytical procedures. And once you have the radio tracer, it is evaluated. So the evaluation, first of all, we make sure we have the right thing that we were expecting in the right concentrations with the right pH, and that it is going to be stable in the solution in which we have prepared it. And then we test it in cells or in tissues that we have obtained from various disorders in animal models or from brain bank, from human tissue. Then we would inject the tracer into animal models and see how it is distributed within the various organs in the body. And we would then test in healthy animals and then animal models of disease. So the idea of this testing is to see whether the compound actually enters into the region that we are interested in studying, whether it's able to distribute to where we want it to go, so that we can look at the kinetics. So that's essentially how the compound moves, the formation of the metabolites that I mentioned before, especially the metabolites that are radioactive, and then quantification of the specific binding to the target that we want to study. So that's using pharmacokinetic modeling. Once we have all this and we have information about the toxicity of this compound, if any, then we can apply for regulatory approval before it can actually be tested in clinic and finally applied to the clinic. So in general, a preclinical study would happen like this. We would put an animal under anesthesia, place a cannula in a vein and in an artery. The tracer would be injected through a vein, and we would sample blood fairly rapidly over time of the scan through an artery. And the scan would start with the injection of the tracer. The blood that is collected during the scan, it would be checked for the amount of radioactivity as well as the amount of any metabolites that are formed to get what we call a time activity curve, which is the amount of activity over time. And from the scan, we would obtain images, which is what people usually tend to see. And from a dynamic scan, we can get, again, a time activity curve from the region of interest, in this case, a brain. And then we can perform kinetic analysis to see the movement of the tracer across the blood-brain barrier and its binding to the receptor or the target of interest, and fit models to the data to arrive at our results. So once we do the preclinical work, it gets translated to the clinic, but then it can come back because something was not right. The affinity that we found in the preclinical setting might be quite different from what is in the clinic. So this is a iterative procedure, essentially. So it is quite a lengthy process. And once we have the information from the human PET study, it could then be translated into regular application in the clinic. So coming to mathematics in PET, so I use mathematics in PET to study the pharmacokinetics. So the word pharmacokinetics comes from pharmakon, which is drug, and kinetikos, which is movement. So it's essentially what the body drug does to the drug, or in our case, to the tracer. Usually, it consists of the absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion of the compound. But in our case, since it is directly injected into the blood, there's no step of the absorption, so we start at the distribution. So the data that we use, as I mentioned before, it is the time activity curve from our region of interest, which is from a dynamically reconstructed PET image. And input function could be of two types. One that I already mentioned, from the blood samples that are collected over time. So this would mean putting in a cannula in a human patient into the artery, which is not really pleasant. The data that we obtain from here should be corrected for metabolites and for any binding to plasma proteins. But there's another possibility to get the input function, which could be from the image itself, but not in every single conditions, only in those conditions where there's something called a reference region. That is a region devoid of the specific binding, but has the same non-specific binding as is in our region of interest. So modeling, there are lots of models possible, reversible, irreversible, with using plasma input or reference input. But in general, these models are either model-driven compartment models or data-driven graphical analysis. There are a few assumptions that are made when we do PET kinetic modeling. One is that what we inject is in trace amounts, so tracer amounts approaching zero. Therefore, why I mentioned this importance of specific activity before, the mass of the compound that we inject should be as low as possible. Steady state, so during the scan, nothing should change. For example, if you're going to look at FDG, which is a marker of metabolism, of glucose usage by the body, the glucose, blood glucose level should not change during the scan. It should be the same throughout. Or if you're going to look at receptor occupancy by a drug, then that concentration of the drug should not be changing too rapidly during the scan duration. And the third assumption is that of instantaneous mixing. So wherever we are looking at a particular compartment, it should have the same tracer concentration. So coming to the actual model, the concentration of the tracer in plasma, CP, and then it moves, in this case I'm talking of course about brain and about a receptor. So there's a rate constant for it to enter the brain across the blood-brain barrier and to exit the brain, K2, that's to from the compartment that we call brain free, because whatever is available here is free to bind to something. Then there is the brain bound, the specifically bound concentration, that's the one we want to analyze. We want to know how much is specifically bound to our target of interest. And there's this non-specific binding which we tend to collapse into the free, because it is quite a rapid, rapidly equilibrating compartment. So single tissue compartment model, this is to look at compounds, tracers that need not bind to brain. So we want to see what's the cerebral blood flow, for example. So this compound goes in and comes out, does not bind to anything. It could also be for compounds that goes in, binds and comes out, but the binding rate cannot be separated from the rate of flow into and out of the brain. Therefore, these also come under single tissue compartment models. And the curve tend to look like this, goes up fairly fast and comes out fairly fast out of the brain. So in this case, the total CT that you see, concentration in the tissue, would include concentration that's free, that is non-specifically bound, and concentration that's specifically bound. So it's not possible to separate out the specific binding in this case. And the outcome measure that we get out of this is VT. So from that compartment that I showed, after a lot of equations which I've not included here, you get VT is equal to K1 over K2, which is essentially the ratio of concentrations in tissue and plasma. When it comes to two tissue compartment model, there are two kinds. There's the reversible kind, where there is actually a K4, which is dissociation from the target, and an irreversible form where there is no dissociation from the target during the period of the scan. It could be dissociating later, but we don't care about it. So one example of that is what I mentioned before, FDG, which goes into the cell, reacts with the process, and then gets trapped there. So over time, it stays there, essentially. So the reversible form, the curves tend to look like this, so not as sharp as before, because that includes the sharp curve of K1 over K2 and a more shallower curve of K3 over K4. So it's a combined curve, and kinetic modeling is used to separate out these two curves to obtain the information from it. And an irreversible curve would look like this. Over time it goes up but does not come down. And in this case, the what is called non-displaceable includes the free and non-specifically bound, and the specifically bound in the bound compartment. So again, after a lot of equations which I've skipped, we get our outcome measures. There are three outcome measures that are possible from here. VT, which is the total distribution volume, which is K1 over K2 multiplied by 1 plus K3 over K4. So this is a ratio of what is there in the tissue to what is there in plasma, essentially. We also can get the volume which is non-displaceably bound, which is K1 over K2. This gives us information about the flow of the tracer and the permeability of the blood-brain barrier. We also get BPND, which is what everyone wants, which is the non-displaceable binding potential, K3 over K4, which gives information about receptor numbers and the function of the receptors, which is equivalent to Bmax over Kd from in vitro studies, but Bmax does not equal K3 and Kd does not equal K4. It's just the ratio that's equivalent. Therefore, VT, total volume of distribution, includes both the non-displaceable volume of distribution and binding potential. We can look at the individual k values, but they may not be stable and they could be quite variable. So what is usually looked at is Vt or BPND. Now, these compartment models are iterative models, so they take a lot of computational effort, and it's not quite feasible to look at individual voxels in the image if you want to compare voxel-wise between groups. So then we look for simplification like linearization, where examples are Patlak plot for irreversible binding and Logan plot for reversible binding. And other simplification that I've also mentioned before is to try and avoid blood sampling where there are reference tissues available. So that's a reference tissue model. An example of that is a simplified reference tissue model where the reference tissue has the same non-displaceable volume as that of our target and has no specific binding. Therefore, we can we'll be able to estimate the binding potential and not just the total volume of distribution. But this, of course, would require a reference tissue, which is not available for all targets, because there are for some targets there are regions of brain it is present and regions of brain where it's not present. But other targets that we are interested in is present all over the brain. This is another example from the Nimrod study that I mentioned before, using 18F AV1451, which binds to the misfolded protein tau. In this study was on Alzheimer's disease, progressive supranuclear palsy, and in healthy controls. So, and it's you have the reference here. So, this compound tends to non-specifically bind to a region, so we are still trying to find out what it is non-specifically binding to, but with reference to the specific binding, you can see there's quite a difference between AD patients and controls. So what is estimated here using the SRTM model is the binding potential, BPND. I've barely touched upon kinetic modeling that's used in PET, so this information is available on this PET pharmacokinetics course, which usually takes place around major PET conferences. The previous two manuals are available online, but if you would like to attend an actual course, there's one taking place in July in London as a part of this NRM conference. So I would really suggest, if you're interested, to go to that. And finally, this is my last slide. So what are the current challenges that I would like help from you mathematicians is, one, in lead selection, to be able to select the right lead that could enter the brain, that can dissolve in all the structures that we need, which will not produce radioactive metabolites. So any kind of computational modeling that can simplify the lead selection would be much appreciated. But I think most clinicians would be more interested in the second one, to make PET studies truly non-invasive so that we don't have to sample blood from people who are quite sick, and not to trouble them too much. So in absence of reference regions, can we get reference information from the PET image itself without having to take blood samples? Yeah, so thank you. And these are the two teams that are working on all this, the MICL team from the WIBIC and the radiopharmaceutical unit where they actually produce the tracers for clinical studies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, any questions on PET radiopharmaceuticals and methods? So you can get other kinetic information from other modalities, and in particular with PET-MR you have the potential to correlate the kinetics of the two. Can you say anything about how well that information is utilised?
I'm not quite familiar with how it is done with respect to MR, but a major problem would be to do both simultaneously. So PET-MR simultaneously is possible in clinic, but not so far in preclinical space. To get it's usually sequential preclinically to get the information at the same time. But I believe people are working on it to get the flow, especially flow-related information from MR.
How many tracers are actually used in hospitals now? Patients rather than research?
Quite a lot are available. It depends on what the clinicians want to use for, but there are a lot of methods that are established that have gone through GMP procedures and validated and available. So you can look at oxygen usage in the body, you can look at dopamine receptors, dopamine transporters, serotonin. So it depends on what you want to look at.
And that's used routinely in patients?
Yes. Yes.
But is it with dynamic data, or is it just taking a late frame?
It depends on what is known about the tracers. So you can validate, depending on the tracers, that you get the same information as you would get from a dynamic data by just looking at maybe after injection, 1 hour you wait and then scan for 30 minutes, and then you would get the same information. So if there's not that much of a difference, then you would use what we call standardized uptake value, SUV, for that portion of the scan.
Some of these traces are pretty expensive. Where does the majority of that cost come from? Which part of that process?
So I think it would be mostly to obtain the PET isotope and to make sure everything is GMP. So you'd want something that's injected into the body to be as good a quality. So it should be in a completely sterile situation. Everything that goes into the room is sterile. The person who's in there is as clean as possible, covered up. So the whole process of it, I think, involves having specialized
labs. Some things like FDG are relatively cheap.
Yes.
Compared to some of the, you know, the PK11195s.
Yeah.
Is that the molecule in the first place to create that? I mean, I don't know how that's synthesized. Is that done on a daily basis, or is that from a bottle from the shelf?
So none of these can be a bottle from the shelf because of their short half-life. So FDG.
Okay, but essentially taking that stuff, but then it needs to mix with your radioactive components.
Yes,
but is that a long process then?
So things like FDG, which has been around for a long time, and it is fluorine 18 labeled. So these can be done centralized in one place, and then it can be sent out to hospitals in different places. But anything with carbon 11, you require a cyclotron in your facility to be able to do. So that is likely to be more expensive than something that can be made in one pot and then sent out to different centers.
When you develop and synthesize these radio tracers, how do you determine what kind of molecules or what kind of radioisotopes you're going to use?
So it depends on the structure of the chemical structure of the lead compound that you know will bind to your target of interest. Whether it's easy to introduce a carbon 11 into it, or it already has a fluorine 18 in it, so you can replace that fluorine 18 with a fluorine 19 in it, and you can replace it with the fluorine 18. The chemical properties of a compound will change if you remove a carbon and put in a fluorine, for example, though it's not as simple as that. So it depends on the chemical structure, what kind of radioisotope is introduced in there.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
This is,